Hello, Acceleration Nation. On today's podcast, we have a guest from down under in Australia. His name is Zubin Pratap, and he is a very impressive guy. He has had three career switches, very distinct careers from the legal side to the commercial side to engineering to software engineering. And he became so good at all of these things. He worked at big global telecom companies like Telstra, which is the biggest telecom company in Australia. And he eventually got into Google. He worked there for a couple of years and he chose to leave because it wasn't good for him and his lifestyle. But this is a great episode for people that are interested in pivoting careers, understanding that it's not only about the subject matter expertise, but also gaining that advocacy and that support, and also having the fortitude of being rejected. And you'll hear about Zubin got rejected 53 times from moving from the law field to the commercial side. So I think you'll really dig this episode, especially for people that are looking to pivot their careers and understanding how to do that. Before we get into this episode, just a quick reminder of how we at Kadima Careers can help you in your career. We are experts at getting people great jobs quickly, confidently, and with lots more money. So if you are looking to make a career switch, if you're looking for a great job, a better job, we can help you. There's three ways we help you. One, we have a digital course called the Job Acquisition Method, where we have broken down our formula to get you more interviews, more offers, and money. It's everything in a digital course, worksheets, templates, scripts, and so forth, everything you need. If you're someone who likes being in a community, in a very vibrant, lively, supportive group, we have group coaching as well. So you get the digital course, but you also have access to the group for 6 months. Then finally, if you're someone who is really eager to get this job super quickly with the most money possible, we have personalized coaching where you work one-on-one with top-notch, world-class coaches that I have hand-selected that will get you that better job guaranteed. Go to our website, kadimacareers.com, K-A-D-I-M-A, careers.com to find out. And now listen to this episode. And if you like the Sick Career Podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe. Our success depends on that. And also, I will very much appreciate that. So before we dig into this episode, the last three words I shall leave you with are own your career. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sick Career Podcast. Today, I am really happy and excited to have a guest from down under in Australia, Zubin Pratap. Zubin and I met, how I meet most people nowadays, on LinkedIn. This is a situation where Zubin reached out to me, and we'll talk a little bit about what led Zubin to reach out to me, how he approached me, because I think that's a good example of how everybody on LinkedIn are potential new connections for you. But Zubin has a very interesting career. He's had multiple different pivots in his career, from the legal profession to coding to being a software engineer at Google. Now he's helping people make those same pivots. I want to introduce Zubin to you right now. And then Zubin, tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Sure. Thanks, Alan, for having me. It's great. I reached out because I really like the kind of stuff you're doing. I'm one of those people who believe that careers aren't what they used to be. A lot of the stuff we brought up believing about careers was true in our parents' generation, but increasingly that's changing a lot between generations or even within the same generation now. We know that's happening really fast. And a little bit about background about myself. I'm in my early 40s. I'm here in Australia. I've been in Australia about 18 years, and I was about 37, 38 when I learned to code and became an engineer, and then joined Google as a software engineer, and now at Chainlink Labs in the blockchain space. And along the way, I had a couple of other smaller career changes, not as many as you, because I think, if I'm not mistaken, Alan, I think you've had seven. That's
yeah, I'm on my seventh career.
Yeah, when I
hopefully my last Alan.
Yeah. No, that's quite extraordinary. I've had about three of maybe four, if you count one. I don't really count that. It's an adjacency, but about three. And in multiple countries, I've had the privilege of working in, you know, four countries now. And over 20 years, there's a world before LinkedIn, there's a world after LinkedIn. And I think those of us that knew the world before LinkedIn understand a lot more about how careers were done then, as opposed to how it's done now. It's a different game.
Yeah, awesome. On the point of pivoting on the LinkedIn thread here, you have in your about section in LinkedIn, it says, I've worked in four countries and successfully built careers in three domains, international corporate law, commercialization strategy, and software engineering. So different. Talk to me about how you made those different pivots in your career and how you were able to actually convince somebody to take a chance on you with not having the experience that you had that they needed initially?
Yeah. So that second part of the question, how do you convince people? That's actually the hardest bit. Most people tend to focus entirely on the obvious stuff, which is what are the skills I need to acquire? Right. But that is absolutely table stakes. That is the ticket to the dance. That is literally step one in what I consider to be a 5 or 7 step process, right? Depending on how you're looking at it. So for me, yeah, I started my career as a lawyer. I went to law school 98 to 2003. Just to put that in context, Google had just come out of Stanford at that point in time. It wasn't even a listed company. Gmail wasn't a thing. Yahoo was still the dominant search engine in 98. And by the time I came out in 2003, it was Google. And the dot-com boom had happened. The bust had happened. Like, it was a different world, right? Just to put that in context, 2003, I started my career in law. It was back in India, and I was a trial and litigating lawyer. And then I moved to corporate, which is a big change. Then I moved to Australia. And long story short, about 10, 12 years in, I started to see that the world had changed a lot. Like all of us, I built my career plan based on what had happened before. So in 98, I joined law school because for the 20 years before that, law was a really good, great career to have. And our parents tell us that this is probably the right, safe, logical choice for someone like you. So that's how the first career happened. I loved it, but it wasn't me. There wasn't real alignment, but I didn't have the maturity or the vocabulary or the self-awareness to know that. And there was this building sense of, this is not me. I'm in the wrong world. I'm getting really good at things that don't make me come alive, is how I used to think about it. And so I decided, you know, 10, 12 years in, there's a lot of sunk costs going on. You know, you move country. I'd moved to Australia by this time. Along the way, I'd worked briefly at the UN on a 6-month thing and then moved to Australia. I'd done stuff in India and things like that. And it was really hard to move to the business world first. And my number one go-to approach for that now in hindsight is you've got to be doing the job before you get offered it. And that's the challenge. You've got to be doing at least 50% of that work and operating in that realm before somebody else will take a chance. And when I actually moved from law to the business side of things, you know, a more sort of managerial and then eventually an executive-y kind of role, I was rejected more than 53 times from within the same company, and it had 50,000 people in it. And every one of them, Alan, you're going to like this, every one of them, when I told them, and I wasn't actually asking for work, and I said, do you think I could do the work? Different question. They would say, of course, you're a bright enough guy, you're a lawyer, you can do all kinds of things, right? Of course you can. Why wouldn't you be able to make that move? Okay, would you give me a job? No, because you haven't got the experience, or because, you know, it's too risky, or because of whatever reason, I've got somebody else in mind. And it was always a very polite reason, but basically it was why would I take a chance? I've got other options. That was the subtext. And so I had to start doing that work before I got offered it. And then eventually, when you knock on enough doors, somebody's going to say, hey, you're really serious about this. Do you want me to tell you about how I moved into software engineering then?
Well, we'll get to that in a second. Okay. But first, I want to go back to, you got rejected 53 times. Was that while you were at Telstra?
Yes.
So these were internal mobility opportunities that you were exploring and you were getting rejected left and right on these?
So internal mobility as a concept is quite a strongly American one. It does exist. The verbiage around it is a bit different in other countries. Internal mobility suggests that there's a pathway for these kind of things. It's a structure. It's a part of the formal approach that companies have. Telstra was very open to these kind of things, but not really commonly done across domain, like that big a leap at a middle level. Like, I didn't have the capital or the equity in the company to be able to just say, hey, I'm just going to jump. Like, our head of legal had eventually moved into an operations role. Like, that happened at that level. But at my level, it didn't happen that much. It was very rare.
But you eventually were able to move within Telstra. Yes. Let's talk a little bit about Telstra, because you were there for 7 years. I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile. Yeah. You were legal counsel for a few of those. Senior commercial manager. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah.
Emerging tech commercial manager. Yeah. So it looks like you were getting more customer facing, more technical from some of these terms. So it looks like you had like 5 or 6 roles, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 roles while at Telstra.
Yeah.
But you applied for like 53. So you have a 10% hit rate or something like that.
The first 2 or 3 were all legal roles. So those are great because there's a lot of internal mobility within the various legal teams. There's a lot of mobility there. Moving to more commercial roles where you have to do a lot of commercial negotiations, handle P&Ls, look at spreadsheets, that kind of stuff, make more strategic discussions.
That's where a lot of the friction first came in, going from legal to the commercial side.
2013 to 2015. The first commercial role was 2015, right? And look, a lot of it was me. I was asking the wrong questions and I was not delivering or proving the value. I was looking for validation in the form of an invitation to a role. And this was a learning journey for me. I was not familiar with how to do this at that point in time. And I didn't really have great mentors at that point in time or know about the concept of mentorship. So I was asking, and I think my tone, my entire approach was, hey, do you think I could do this? And would you take a chance on me? As opposed to, hey, I can do this, full stop.
So how did you eventually convince people? So making the move first from legal to the commercial side.
Yeah.
You got a lot of rejections until someone eventually took a chance on you.
Yeah.
Talk a little about the rejections and talk about how you were either able to convince or you at least found somebody who would take a chance on you. And that was your first pivot, right? From legal to the commercial to software.
Yes.
Just to being a software engineer. But how did you make that first pivot?
It was incremental. And initially, it would never go past those conversations, like I mentioned. Yeah, of course, you can do anything. Fine. Is there a role in your org or your team that you'd be considering it? It was that vague. Bad questions. And then I realized I was getting a pattern of answers, which is you can do it, but no, we're not going to take a chance on you. Or what would you like to do? That was initially like, what would you like to do? And I realized actually I'm asking bad questions here because I'm not coming up with a firm enough proposal. I improved that. Then the firm enough proposals are still resulting in no. And when I say firm enough proposal, I'm like, I know there's this role going in your team. I know this is the kind of work and I know this is the kind of output required. And I believe I can do this. And at that point in time, it was not really, you don't have the background. Okay. So then I educated myself on a bunch of concepts, whether it was business concepts or P&L concepts, the internal language. I'd look at what other people were doing and I would sprinkle that in my conversation so that I would not look like such an outsider, which is now something I teach my students, which is you got to sound like an insider, even if you're an outsider. You've got to speak the language, right? You have to have the intuition about the domain. And so I did that. And then that got me my first few interviews. And then I got rejected at those. And so each time I was repeating my efforts without repeating my past mistakes. And so through that incremental process, I was figuring out the puzzle of the psychology behind the no, right? And I hadn't yet had run my own team at that point in time outside of the law anyway. I hadn't really run my own team. So I didn't know the perspective of a hiring manager. I wasn't in their shoes until I got into these roles and then I was managing people. And then I'm like, so this is what the world looks like from the vantage point of a hiring manager. And there's all this structure, there's all this process, there's all this expectation from HR and finance and all the other guys. And you have to defend your decision. We're all busy. Why would I take a chance on someone when it's just so much easier? The path of least resistance is take that highly qualified person from within the team or from outside that has applied 200 applicants. Why wouldn't I take the top three? Like, why would I go with Zubin? Why would I take that risk?
Our listeners around the world who may not have heard of Telstra, my understanding of Telstra, it's like one of the biggest telecom companies in Australia, or maybe the biggest one in Australia, right? It's like
Verizon or AT&T. Yes, it's AT&T. That's the metaphor. That's the comparison I always draw. It's like the Aussie AT&T. Yes.
So it's a big, large organization. And the person that eventually hired you for your first non-legal job, how were you able to influence that person to take a chance on you? Because that person ultimately had to choose you versus someone that had that commercial experience, whether internal or external.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing they were probably looking at internal candidates and external candidates simultaneously.
Yeah, so it was interesting. So it was a bit of they needed someone like me. So it's like, you know, I was rereading Arnold Schwarzenegger's Total Recall, right? Fantastic book, by the way, where he says everyone is mocking for this enormous, monstrous body. And then the Terminator movie opportunity comes along and they're like, we actually, if you didn't have someone who looked like you, we'd have to build it, was what, you know, I believe Cameron sent to him. It was a little bit like that. So what ended up happening was people had heard about, hey, this guy's been trying for 2 years. He's persistent. And everyone liked me. That's the thing. It really helps to be the sort of person that can build relationships. And again, that's a learned and acquirable skill. And so this gentleman called Nick called me up. He was one of the most senior managers. And I was very transparent with my management and legal that, hey, this is my next step in my career. You know, I could keep rising up the legal ladder, but I believe I can also add value here. So one of my bosses had mentioned to Nick, we've got a guy who's been looking. I recommend him. He's good. It's a different domain. And Nick called me up. And I remember I was in Indonesia at that point in time. And he said, look, this may happen in the next 6 months or 3 quarters. We don't know. But it's a role that involves a lot of negotiating. It's a role that involves a lot of really clear thinking. And I believe you can learn the rest. If it comes through, would you be interested? And I said, yes. Like, straight up. Yes. You know, I'll take any opportunity. Yes. And that eventually worked out. There were some questions that were raised and all the rest of that about, is this the best candidate? Like HR would do that in a very sophisticated, in a very large organization. I think I had the backing and I just had the visibility at that point in time that this guy must be serious. He wasn't just asking 3 or 4 times and then giving up. Like he's been persistent, you know.
And what I hear there, this guy, Nick, was like pulling for you or supporting you. You also had the support from your existing manager. It ultimately required advocacy. You were able to do the job.
Yes.
It might've been tough the first few months, the first 6 months of learning a new business, but you clearly have the capability of doing it. And probably about 50% of candidates that are interviewing for a job are capable of doing the job. And then it's just a matter of you getting the break.
Absolutely, Alan. And when I was on the hiring and interviewing side, even at Google and stuff, Google's an interesting example because the top applicants at Google are just mind-blowingly phenomenal. And it's a really hard job to pick. And that really broadened sharp focus for me. Just how being good at what you do is not actually a USP at a lot of levels. There's so much more that goes into the soup. And let's be clear, luck's a part of it. There is no life where luck and magic don't count. That's there. But that's only there to give you the extra boost, right? And again, being good at your job. People always ask for the one thing and it annoys me a little bit because it's so limiting. It's never the one thing. It has to be everything and a little bit of magic.
Yeah, magic, luck, whatever you want to call it, like right place, right time.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're at Telstra for about 7 years. And then from there, you were doing commercialization. You were doing like customer facing work. Talk to me about from like the commercial side of the business to say, hey, now I want to be a software engineer. What happened there? And then you took multiple steps before you wound up at Google, by the way. It's not like all of a sudden you just picked up a coding book and you wound up getting hired at Google.
No. So what actually happened? So when I was doing the commercial strategy role, which is a lot of negotiations and managing sort of product through the channels. And then after that, I moved to emerging technology because by this time I knew I was really interested in technology. I was feeling a bit left out of that world. And there was no clear path for me to get into that in Australia. America is obviously a much bigger market, much bigger country, and has a stronger track record of mixing up and mixing and matching talent to the opportunity. And so I went into this emerging technology role, which is basically looking at all the new technologies and whether we should be commercializing them at Telstra. So I was meeting a different kind of person. I was doing less negotiations and that sort of commercial work and more into a different kind of commercial work, which is really like product development, scouting a product and looking at developing it, either through acquiring it or building it. Whole different skill set. By this time, I'd already tried my hand at startup, which basically is I paid a bunch of coders to build a product which I never shipped because I didn't know how to ship it. I didn't know anything about it. And I was really frustrated how little I knew and how much that was holding me back. And then I decided, okay, at this point in time, I was 36, I think, Alan. And I remember the day very clearly sitting at level 28 in Telstra thinking, I just finished my MBA. And I'd already done the commercial switch before I did my MBA. I did my MBA to put the icing on the cake a little bit and to remove the objection once and for all.
Did you do that part-time while you were at Telstra?
Yeah. So I did an MBA globally and I had to travel every 6 weeks. They were very supportive of it. It was really intense. But it wasn't the MBA so much. It was the schedule I mentioned on the MBA that actually changed my life. But that it was the schedule I maintained during the MBA because I was working full-time. I had to complete the MBA in 15 months. And so I was working round the clock 7 days a week on this program. And it changed me. And I suddenly had a new respect for time and how much could be done in it. And so I wanted to maintain that momentum right after the MBA. And I said, if I don't leave my comfortable paid corporate job where I'm doing really well now, I will never do this. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. Now's the time for me to screw it up because, okay, I know how to get back into these kind of places. I have the credibility and the social capital. I can get back if I need to. The worst case scenario is I lose a few years of income. I lose some of my savings. I'm 40 and I have to come back to the corporate world. It won't be terrible. It'll be a real kick in the teeth, but it's not fatal. And I asked my then wife, my wife and I split up since we're still very good friends, but I asked my then wife, I'm like, should I do this? And she was very supportive. She said, I'll probably never see you, but you know, you've been wanting to do this for a long time. This has been in you for a long time. And so I just quit. And I had an idea for an application. I was so naive, had no clue what it's like to actually build something like that. And anyway, did that and didn't have a technical co-founder. It was hideous, very set back by all of that. I paid a lot of money building this out, built it out, shipped it, got these proof of concept deals with local governments to prove the concept out, and found a technical co-founder who actually built, I paid him and another team to build the first version of the application. They liked it. He came on board. Then he ended up having a baby. And so he quit. And so left me holding the proverbial baby. And I'm like, if I don't learn to code, I will not be able to honor these agreements for proofs of concepts and trials that I've got with local governments. I literally was knocking on local governments and mayor doors. I would go to meetings uninvited just to get them to listen to me. And I'm like, they've taken a chance on me too. By this time, I'd learned how to pitch and sell and how to be persistent and what people need. I did get some doors open. And then I said, if I don't learn to code, this is going under. So I learned to code mainly to maintain the app that Luke had built and to deliver on it. And I could see the unit economics was not working out. And I just decided, okay, I really love writing code. I'm just going to now get to a professional level of that. And so I shut down the startup and I did a little bit of consulting here and there to keep the lights on. But I basically just devoted myself finally to learning to code. And 8 months later, I had 4 opportunities, all 4 that I applied for. Again, learning how to work with the marketplace helped a lot to get all 4. I only applied to 4 and got 4. And then a year after that, I joined Google. So it wasn't a linear path. It wasn't planned.
Okay. So you left Telstra. You started this startup. You were working more on the commercial side. You had a technical co-founder. He left. So then you had to figure out coding.
Yeah.
Then you went getting passionate about that and you kept going down the path. You actually wound up becoming a teacher on it, like at Udemy, right? And I know you do a lot of coaching now, but you serendipitously fell into this. You decided that you really were passionate about this. Then you decided to leave the startup space. You started interviewing for roles and you got 4 different opportunities, or you worked for 4 different companies?
I got 4 different offers. All 4 that I applied for, I got 4 different offers as a software engineer. Yeah.
Okay. But that was not at Google. Who would not hire someone who's just like tinkering around with coding?
Right. I didn't even bother to apply because I know how these places work. By the way, and just along the way, I had applied to Google when I was a lawyer. I'd applied to Google when I was in the commercial world and I got rejected. In the commercial world, I think I made it up to the final round in a product interview and I didn't clear that. Okay. And then I didn't even bother with Google for the software engineering thing because I'd actually tried to learn to code 2013, 2014, 2015, 2016. I tried to learn to code 4 different years. 2017, I did this. I left and started the startup thing. 2018, I found a co-founder. Later in 2018, he quit. And 2018, I said, that's it. I just have to learn to code now. So that was my 5th attempt, I think. And 2019, I became a programmer. 2020, I joined Google.
Okay. So how many times did you get rejected from Google before you finally got hired?
Across 3 different careers. Software engineering, never. I got partly lucky in that the first time I applied for a software engineering role at Google, sorry, that's not necessarily true. I applied for a couple of roles and I think I got rejection letters. And then eventually I did get the one that I did, but it was all at the same period of time. I just applied for different roles. It was all in the same month and one of them worked out. But yeah, I got rejected maybe 5 or 6 times. Most of the times I didn't even hear back past the first interview. And yeah, keep in mind 2014, 2010, 2012, I must have applied for Google roles, I think, after 2012. Or maybe, yeah, LinkedIn wasn't as pervasive as it is now. I think people don't realize this. In the last 5 years, LinkedIn has blown up. Back then, it wasn't just LinkedIn. There were lots of other things you had to do to get even knowledge of the opportunity.
Yeah. And I think I was a 5-time rejected. I got rejected 5 times from Google before they finally hired me. And that's actually a key element that people don't understand. A lot of people get rejected once or twice, or sometimes just once from a company. And they're like, hey, I'm not Google material. I'm not Microsoft material. But in reality, I don't know if these companies like the fact that you keep applying, but it's actually a positive because it shows how committed you are to them. And unless you totally bomb, like there are a couple times when you can interview and you do a really crappy job and you get essentially blackballed. There's a checkbox that you can do when you're interviewing someone to say, hey, Zubin's not a good fit for this role or Zubin's not a good fit for Google.
Yeah.
And it's not just Google that does that. Almost every company I've worked at has those different exit paths of somebody.
Yeah.
That perseverance wound up paying off. But still, before Google, you were a full stack engineer at Applus. I've never heard of Applus, but
it's small,
a highly sophisticated enterprise grade SaaS offering, or at least how you describe it on your LinkedIn portfolio. But you also had Telstra on your background, and Telstra is a big name,
yeah,
especially in Australia. How did you ultimately get into Google? Was it a cold application or was it a referral? How did you get someone to actually say, hey, we're going to interview Zubin for a software engineering role or a SWE role?
Oh, absolutely. By this time, I realized that referrals get you past the first gatekeeper, right? It's one less. As the filter goes, the first gatekeeper is going to filter most. And then at each progressive level, there's less people to filter and therefore less filtering, even if as a percentage may be quite high. So again, I'd learned all this before Telstra. I was at Baker McKenzie, which is a very well-regarded global law firm. I had the track record through my career, what different parts of the world look like, how things are done in different parts of the world. And so when I was applying for Google, my resume looked a bit different from how it was applying for Australian roles, small things like that. And I did get referred into the Google role that I eventually accepted. I did get referred into that. But again, that was partly serendipity, right? So my best friend, who I consider my brother, lives in LA. I visited him. He had a new neighbor who was then at Google. And I was learning to code at that point in time. And I just made the switch. And he was super impressed. He said, hang on, you're how old? And you did this all on your own. And he asked me a few questions. And he's like, you actually know something. And he didn't mean that in an arrogant way. He was just really surprised that I'd done this. And I said, yeah, but you're looking at the result of 5 years of struggle, like I tried and failed and tried and failed, tried and failed. And, but this time I'm really serious about this because this is the only way forward. I don't want to go back to the old life. And so Ethan was like, okay, if you ever need a referral, let me know. Cause that's the kind of people we respect. And that's what happened. I said, okay, when I'm ready, I'll let you know. And I didn't do it right away. I had to prepare for it.
This guy, Ethan, referred you in. You got into Google. You were there for almost 2 years. Yeah. Did you get hit by the 12K layoffs in 2020? No. Were you part of that riff?
No, I think that happened 2023, didn't it?
Oh yeah, you're right. I'm losing track of it. Yeah.
No, I left right after the pandemic because Australia went through one of the worst shutdowns. Oh, not one of the hardest, most stringent shutdowns on the planet. And that was challenging for a lot of us. And my wife and I weren't sure whether we could move to San Francisco anymore for some personal reasons. So when the US opened up, in fact, I'd already moved to a Sydney-based team at that point in time because I said, look, there's a good chance I may not be able to move to Mountain View anymore. But this time I'd also realized that as great as Google was, I wasn't going to be trapped by the brand name anymore. And there was something that I wanted to move to in my 40s. I had certain goals and I'd changed a lot during the pandemic as well. And being the only son of one single mom, I was raised by a single mom. She hasn't been single now for 20 years, but I wanted to spend more time with my mom and she lives in Norway. And I said, I can't do that at Google because they don't let me work flexibly. Whereas Chainlink, places like that, younger companies can work anywhere in the world. So this year I spent 3 months or 2.5 months with my mom, just going, working there. Yeah.
So you left there because of like work-life decision of being able to see your mom more. And also, I guess Google wanted you to relocate to the States.
Yeah. And there was a third reason, which was important to me, which I wouldn't have had the courage to do that in my 20s or early 30s, was Google is no longer a startup or a scale-up. It is a very large company. And yes, it's a lot of prestige, but I've been in big companies in my life and I noticed the signs and I'm like, there was a reason I didn't want that. It really works for some people and it's a wonderful and I love my time at Google is fantastic, but I'm like, I'm going back. I'm repeating an old pattern here. This is not what I want for the next stage of my career.
Yeah. And I think you had the benefit coming in of working for a large multinational organization with Telstra. So having that global brand was less valuable to you, was less novel to you.
Absolutely. And also realizing the impact, the different kinds of careers, like Atlas is 4 people. Smallest enterprise I've ever worked for. Possibly the best in terms of learning, growth. And there's a difference between riding a motorbike and being on a giant cruise ship, right? Atlas was a motorbike. It was built together in a garage and barely sputtered to life, but it was a lot of fun. And Google is a luxury cruise ship.
Definitely luxury. All high-end material there.
Yeah.
So now you help people pivot their careers into like software engineering. Is that true?
Yes, I do that part-time really because I still work full-time as an engineer because I love that. I'm not quite ready to give that up. But I also see way too many people struggling, especially in their 30s. So the reason why there are so few people of my vintage who do this is not because they can't. It's not because they don't want to. It's because they don't have the same flexibility in their life in their 30s that we have in their 20s. The opportunity cost is higher. The sunk cost fallacy is real. Families are real. Obligations to kids are real, etc. So it's a different calculus in your 30s. And I wanted to serve those sorts of people, especially people who can't leave their job and return to a boot camp or college and who want a realistic perspective on career change from someone who's actually done it. Because everyone thinks switching to coding is learning coding. No, that's one of 6 steps, or 5 steps, or 7 steps, depending on where you are. That's the first step. Then you've got to actually do a bunch of other things to get accepted into a new career. And the new domain's probably going to have an allergic reaction to you because you're a foreign body, right?
Yep.
You've got to overcome their immune response to you.
Yeah, because you're fighting friction because whoever's going to take a chance on you wants to mitigate their risk. And the person who's taking a chance on you is a hiring manager and they have that open spot. And they need you to fill that open spot.
Absolutely.
And while there's a very high likelihood that most people can pick up things, they'd rather have someone that can just jump in and hit the ground running.
Yeah. And would you agree? I mean, you've done 7 career changes. Was there always more pieces to the puzzles than just learning the skill?
Every time I actually made the pivot, it was because of advocacy. Like you needed to convince somebody that you can do it. You needed to convince it like a human being.
Exactly.
Can do it. Actually, I had to convince people when I moved from Salesforce to the startup of Kadima. I had to convince one by one my clients that, hey, we can get you a better job. So that was a different one. I went from baseball before business school
I saw that,
to to American Express after, but there was like in that year and a half period of business school, I was building advocacy. I was understanding the different dimensions of American Express. I took a marketing internship at Kraft Heinz, and similar to what you did, you just get some little baby steps under you and you have to prepare for multiple steps. You can't just take coding classes or go to a boot camp and all of a sudden expect that you're going to be a coder at a top flight company.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think even one of your podcasts, I heard that you were in VC before that. Now you wanted to do VC and it ended up being something that wasn't the right fit for you. And I think a lot of people don't realize that's an important part of the journey, because eliminating your hypotheses is a critical step in each progressive incremental step that you take. And it's also the process by which you get clearer on direction, because most people, especially in this day and age, because it's all about the 30-second influencer nonsense, people are so focused on do this fast, learn that fast, learn to code in 30 days, learn this in 90 days. Direction is so much more important than speed. So much more important than speed, because it doesn't matter how fast you go. If you're going the wrong direction, you're not going to get there. You're going to get somewhere else you don't want to be.
And you have to be prepared for multiple steps along the way. I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile. You have 20 experiences identified on LinkedIn, and not everyone has like all of them filled out. I'm sure there's a couple here that you haven't even included there. But with your three careers, you have 20 different experiences along the way. But each one sounds like it was an intentional step to move you forward.
Yeah. And sometimes it was the next best alternative to going backwards. It may not have been what I chose, but it was the next best alternative to going backwards. And it was often sideways, I'd say. Like, there's no doubt about it.
Awesome. So you work with people now that not your day business of Chainlink, but talk about what you do as your side hustle.
Okay. Yeah. So my mission basically is to remove the BS on the internet from the minds of people that come to me. And actually, I help people transition to from wherever they are in their life to, depending on the kind of coding work they want, whether it's data science or web development or something else, in 6 to 12 months without having to give up their job. And the vast majority of people, unfortunately, I have to decline, because I have a very clear principle about this. If I don't know exactly what you need, I'm not going to offer to help you, because I've made a commitment to a no BS policy, because I think there's a lot of people who just want to do it, get the runs on the board, and then say, blame the other person. Now, to be clear, if somebody wants the six pack, I cannot do the ab crunches for them and I cannot do the diet for them. If I don't know how to get them that six pack, I'm not going to offer. I look at it as 6 to 12 months, you should get what you need if you follow this process, and it's not going to be easy. I heavily qualify those who ask to work with me because I don't have a lot of free time, and I work with very small numbers of people, like maybe in a given year, 20 people at most at this point in time. It's very small numbers, because I want to give them the attention it requires. That's why I took the course off Udemy, is because it doesn't matter what I put out there. If only 5% of people are going to do the work, 95% of people are going to have their confidence destroyed and switch and, you know, erode their self-belief. I'm like, I'd rather not go for the big fancy vanity numbers and have the low completion rates and all of that. Oops, sorry, not quite sure what happened there. I'd rather just go for the impact and the high success rate for a low number of people. That's what's really important to me. That's the focus I chose, which is not scalable. It's not cool in this day and age, but I want the outcomes. I'd rather not have collateral damage and work with a few people than work with a large number of people and look cool.
You look cool to me. And I really like the requirement. And this will be the last question before we wrap up, because we are running tight on time here. But you talk about that you work with people for 6 to 12 months, but while they're in their current job. Why do you want that? And as people are pivoting, I think there's tons of reason for that. But I'd love your perspective of why you want people that have a current job while they are starting to carve out their next career.
Very simply, this is what it boils down to. The human mind cannot absorb complex information if it is anxious, if it is distracted. And Maslow's hierarchy has been a very fundamental guiding principle in my life. Like, if you cannot pour into another person's cup until yours is full, right? You cannot pour from an empty vessel. And so we all will chronically underestimate how difficult and how it's going to be any given big goal, whatever it is, right? Losing a lot of weight, becoming an athlete, whatever it is, it's going to take a lot of work. They underestimate it, and they also underestimate the time it may take. And if in that time you run out of money, the despair avalanche snowballs in your head. And that literally interferes with the way your amygdala is going to work. You're going to get distracted. You're going to look at shiny objects. You're going to look at switching. You're going to make panic-based decisions, etc. If you're not secure emotionally and financially, you will not have the patience, in my view, required And worse, and I've seen this happen because a lot of my students, believe it or not, are bootcamp graduates and they give up their jobs. So they think the bootcamp costs 20 grand. What it ends up costing is 20 grand plus 6 months salary plus another 6 months salary when looking for the work. So the total cost is 1 year salary plus the bootcamp fee. Okay.
I have issues with those bootcamps because the raw skills on their own are not going to get you the job. Yeah.
I mean, statistically, it's unlikely. Some people will get it. Even a dead cop will show the right time twice a day. It doesn't mean I'm going to wear it on the wall, right?
So you went a lot deeper there in your philosophy of why you want people having the job. So when people are making career switches, I always tell them to expect longer than it's going to take so that having a job at that time is good. And also while you have a job, there are opportunities for internal mobility there as well. Like you were able to do from legal to the commercial side. So people might be able to take some projects on the technical side at their current organization and then leverage that to a full-time like software engineering job in their new role.
100%. And it may not be possible for everyone, which is also why I do what I do. Like one of my students was successful in Canada last year, was a therapist who ran his own practice, like a counselor, right?
Yeah, from therapy to like software engineering.
And so I've done that with lawyers. I've done that with theater personalities. I've done that with therapists, all sorts of people, truck drivers and stuff. Their context may not allow them to do it. In which case, that roadmap's going to be a bit longer, a bit different, have a different sort of set of turns on it. And you have to customize it to their circumstance. And no one actually knows how long this is going to take. I tell people 6 to 12 months, but sometimes it's going to take 14, sometimes it'll take 7. I don't know. If your timing is end of Q4, you're probably going to have another quarter of waiting. That's just how the market works. Yeah, you don't want to get distracted by that stuff.
So you're talking about a 6 to 12 month plan. Like usually at Kadima, we say 3 to 6 months. On average, it's about 3.39 months. But you're also like pivoting a industry off. And people are coming in.
And they've got acquired technical skills, which is a long time. It's 800 to 1100 hours on average. Yeah.
Awesome, Zubin. So the last topic we'll talk about before we close up is your ability to ask for what you want and reach out to people. So you proactively reached out to me. We engaged on LinkedIn. I actually didn't realize until preparing for this podcast that you weren't still at Google, even though like it's clear on your profile that you're not. But you're just very good at going out and reaching out for things. Like you DM'd me on LinkedIn. You were asking me some questions about my podcast, about the CRM I was using, the calendaring tool. And you got me to answer and respond to you. And like I was looking back on our thread of our conversation, and it was actually a more in-depth conversation than most of my DMs on LinkedIn. That is a key element of your success of pivoting too, of going out there and asking for things. So talk about that. So you're working with people, you're helping them with the technical skills, but then to get that job, there are the soft sides or the elbow grease or whatever you want to call that needs to convince somebody to take a chance on you. So let's just finish up there.
Absolutely. In terms
of your philosophy on that and some tips on that, and then we'll wrap it up with that.
So when I work with people on that coaching, I tell them the coding is the easy stuff because that's going to work the same way for everybody. You smash out the same keystrokes. Doesn't matter where in the world you are, doesn't matter what color your skin is, doesn't matter what your age is, the computer is going to say the same thing, okay? So that's the coding stuff is the easy part. I spend a lot of my time on my students on self-development, communication development, market development, understanding how the market works, because as someone who's only been driving trucks or been in therapy all their life is not going to know how the corporate world works. And people have such different diverse backgrounds that they don't know what they don't know. And they don't know the rules of the game of the world they're trying to enter into. And that's a huge learning in that. And also fundamentally, exactly as you said, advocacy. Advocacy is being able to influence people and convince them that you're a low risk reason or low risk person to back. That's one sentence, but there are so many key moving parts to that one sentence. There are so many points that you need to attack and hit, right? And people are always obsessed about the ingredients. Learn to code, do the interview, data structures and algorithms, crack the code. Those are ingredients. It doesn't matter what your ingredients are. If you don't put them together, your cake's going to come out all wrong. Okay. Yeah. It's always the recipe that matters. And it's individual to each, it's specific to each person. Because some people are good at communication. Some people aren't. Now, I was really bad at the outreach. I was really bad at building advocacy. I had to learn that trial and error, lots of reading, and lots of asking questions.
So I'm going to direct this. So the last two questions I ask people, the penultimate question is, a sick piece of career advice. So for you, what I want to hear are, like you said, you've done lots of reading to improve on these soft skills.
Yeah.
What are some book recommendations you have for the audience here? And also for me, selfishly, what I should be adding to my Audible queue?
Okay. You could read the Dale Carnegie's, you could read the Napoleon Hill's, all that stuff. You could read all the communication books, all the classic texts on that, which are typically coming out from thought leaders or academics. This is going to come out of left field. But if you want a real life story that's contemporary on how each of these elements get hit, honestly, it sounds crazy, but read Total Recall by Arnold Schwarzenegger. It is a full masterclass in life because it comes from an era well before the internet. This guy had to climb on top of trains and stow away on the top of trains to get to a bodybuilding competition at 17 or 16. Like, we talk about resourcefulness, vision, hustle, but keep in mind his context. He came from a village in Austria where they didn't have indoor plumbing. Okay. It's a different world, and just the amount of effort, resourcefulness, imagination, and persistence. And just take away the lessons. The simplest hack to do this is ask yourself, what would I have done in that situation? And I first did this exercise when I read Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, and I counted at least 26 from memory, or 24 or 26 times that I would have quit. I just put myself in issues and said, what would I have done? I would have quit. That's the honest truth. That was back then, right? Maybe it's different now. But asking yourself that question will give you a lot of clues about what to do differently.
Cool. I will add that Arnold Schwarzenegger book, and I do have Shoe Dog in my Audible queue. I've already purchased that. I haven't listened to it yet.
Yeah.
And then Arnold has a new book that he's been promoting.
I've just been listening to that as well. Be useful. Yeah. I've just listened to that as well. Yeah.
But Total Recall's better. It's hard to compare, probably.
Total Recall's the newsletter, and Be Useful's the Twitter tweet. Total Recall is a life story, and it's a big book. But it's worth doing it because you need to follow along in his footsteps. That's the ultimate mentorship. Like, that book is a full mentor relationship right there.
Cool. Yeah. And he's become like quite a profound thought leader later in his life. He probably always was, but he was just known more for his body than his mind.
Yes.
Awesome. And the last question I'll ask you is, where can people find you, reach out to you, and seek your help?
Look, best on LinkedIn. So just look up Zubin Pratap on LinkedIn. And on Twitter/X, same thing, Zubin Pratap. I'm a little more frequent on LinkedIn, but I'm on both. And I have a YouTube channel as well, which is, to be honest, quite nascent. And I'm not into the gloss and the spit and gloss in it. I'm very much a pull out my phone. Hey, I've got this to share with you. And that's it. Like, I'm not into entertaining people. I want to help people who want to be helped, not help people who want to pass the time.
Awesome, Zubin. I really appreciate that our paths crossed on the interwebs. And if ever in Brooklyn, we'll definitely grab a beer, maybe a VB or something like that. But thank you so much for the time, the insight, listening to your story. It's a very inspirational story of how you kind of just figured shit out and didn't take rejection, including 53 rejections, to stop you from doing what you wanted to do and helping to own your career.
That's very kind, Alan. And I wanted to say thank you, because when I found out about the Sick podcast, I did check it out. And I'll be honest, I was a little bit skeptical because there are lots of podcasts, because I'm like, okay. And I saw your background. I'm like, okay, look, this guy has a really solid track record. Let me listen. And I got quite stuck into them. So I started listening to them while cooking and things like that. Thank you for what you do, because there's a rare rawness and honesty to your point of view. But you're clearly a tough love kind of person, which I appreciate, because I think there's a bit too much coddling these days. And you're very to the point. And I hope people realize that you don't have to follow a number of people. You need one or two good people to follow, and that's more than enough to learn what you need. And I'd say you're one of those people that people should be listening to.
Cool, dude, Zubin. I always appreciate compliments. I will gladly have you on the podcast again. Thanks for all you do. Thanks for recording this podcast early your time in Australia, late on a Friday evening in my time. We'll hopefully meet one day in person.
I look forward to that, Alan. Thank you for the opportunity.
Awesome. Thanks a lot.
That wraps up another remarkable episode of the Sick Career Podcast with Alan Stein. Check out past episodes and other resources on the website. That's sickpodcast.com, and it's S-Y-C-K. Alan, tell the audience about the newsletter they can sign up for.
The newsletter rocks. Check out the Accelerator, XLR8R. You will get great tips about your career. You'll get honest insights. You'll get the occasional pet picture. And you will learn how to take proactive control and take charge of your career.
Very good. Very good. That's sickpodcast.com, S-Y-C-K. For your host, Alan Stein, I'm Russ Reba. And we hope you've enjoyed today's episode. You are going to love the next one.